This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our Sex Podcast Collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, it's a topic that we have talked about on the show before, but I don't think we can talk about it enough. And that is LGBTQIA plus competent healthcare. I know a lot of you identify with those letters out there, and you've probably had a range of experiences in dealing with the healthcare system at all levels. And from the various conferences I go to and all the people I talk to, this is still a critical issue. Folks who are queer and trans and non-binary just simply aren't getting competent care, and that affects us on all levels. So I'm really excited to talk to someone who I met quite a while ago and have been trying to get on the show, but, you know, she works in healthcare, so she has a really busy schedule. Let me tell you about her. Karen KB Berger is a physician assistant practicing in Los Angeles, California. She's the founder of Queer Meducation, a platform to educate medical professionals and the general population on LGBTQI and non-binary healthcare through podcasting and social media. So she's also got a podcast called Queer Meducation. She works full-time at the LA LGBT Center in the Sexual Health and Education Department and travels around the U.S. conducting trainings and workshops. She lives in West Hollywood with her wife, Jordan, and her dog, Rilo. She loves to cycle, travel, and drink old fashions. Welcome to the show. I'm going to call you Dr. Karen, but you're not a doctor.
Thank you. Hearing all that out loud is always really funny to me because it sounds like bragging, but it's really just life,
no,
I guess.
It's just you. It's just you. Yeah. Yes. So I want to remind people what a physician assistant is, because it sounds like you're an assistant to the physician, which sounds very low level, but actually you can do, you're ranked right below the doctor and you can do a lot of things, right?
Exactly. Yeah. First off, I want to say thanks for having me. I'm super pumped to be chatting with you today and just really hanging out with you because it's been a while.
It's been a while.
So I love that you're starting off this way because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about different people that work in healthcare and us going into a clinic. There's so many people that are incorporated onto the healthcare team. Sometimes it's kind of hard to keep track of who does what and what their credentials are. So the best way to describe the scope of practice or what I'm able to do as a PA or a physician assistant is very, very similar as a nurse practitioner. So you probably may or may not have heard of a PA because actually the profession was only started in the 1970s. And it actually came out of the armed forces because there was not as many medics available. So PAs kind of came about. So in terms of scope of practice, it's very similar to nurse practitioners. The main differences are I'm board certified under the medical board, whereas nurses are certified under nursing boards. And I'm trained the exact same way as a physician is under the American Medical Association credentials, whereas a nurse practitioner is trained under nursing credentials. But in terms of what I can do, I see patients the same way as an MD, a DO, or an NP does. I will take a history perform a full physical exam, decide what kind of tests I need to order, and then I can then diagnose and prescribe medications and then determine when I should see that patient back. So essentially, I just work as a regular general healthcare practitioner. We also don't specialize. We're trained across the board. So I currently work in a sexual health clinic, but I can decide I want to work in a surgical setting. I can decide I want to work in pediatrics. I can go and work in OBGYN for a little while. Whatever I really want to do, there's some lateral mobility there. The only thing I probably can't ever do unless I pursue further education is be a head surgeon. But otherwise, the scope is pretty much open to most things. Now, we always work on a healthcare team, just like everybody else in healthcare. So when my supervising physician is available, I can kind of chat with them about any sort of cases that are more difficult or challenging in that sort of way.
I mean, this is good to know because, quite frankly, we don't have enough GLBTQI identified healthcare professionals. That's one of the problems, right? Is that,
absolutely,
you know, we don't have enough like out providers. And so we're often relying on non-queer people and cis people to address issues that they may have no personal experience with and no training on top of it.
100%. I mean, the medical system is very, very, very much archaic and behind the times. There are wonderful organizations that have existed, but for many individuals, they feared being fired or having their certifications and their licenses taken away for many, many years. Also, when I think about what a quote doctor looks like, the first image in my head because of visibility is an old white dude. Mm-hmm. And essentially, that's what it was for many, many, many years. And then whatever changed in terms of policies and diversity and inclusion, things are slowly progressing, but it's so incredibly slow. Policy change is very slow. So I think most of the time when you go to see someone to get medical care, you are going to see a cis white person because that's the demographic of individuals. It's slowly changing and there's lots of people making that change, but it's going to take time. So 100% correct.
And I think we've discussed this on the show before, but there is no kind of mandatory training around LGBTQIA issues when you go to medical school or whatever your training is, if you're becoming a nurse practitioner or a nurse. There's no sort of comprehensive part of the curriculum that says, oh, wait, and you might run into these folks. Is that right?
Correct. So there's different governing bodies depending on what type of practitioner you are. And then within that scope of that practitioner, there's the education governing body and the certification governing body and the policy, et cetera. So there are many governing bodies within medicine, for example, the American Medical Association, the American Medical Student Association, the LGBTPA Caucus, and other organizations that have made blanket statements that they are supportive of LGBTQI plus competency and medical training. However, there are no instituted policies that I know of within any particular medical practitioner's scope that is required to teach this particular type of medicine in medical education programs. So essentially what's happening is either people are getting it because there's one, a student that's passionate about it. And essentially the idea is, well, the student can teach it or nobody's going to get this information, or there's a faculty member or someone like me who's kind of noticed this and is pissed off about it and is trying everything they can to go around and travel around and go to different PA programs or other medical programs and talk about this subject. And I've done like a basic 101 in different programs to different individuals in different areas of the country. And it is, I like to say, I blow minds, like on basic things like terminology. What does L stand for? What does B stand for? And for me, it's such a good thing because, not that I'm happy about that, but I live in a queer bubble. Like, I live in West Hollywood. I work at the center. I have a wife. Like, my friends are queer and life is great. And then I step out into, like, quote, general population. And I realize, holy shit. Can I curse on this?
I'm you can yes, say right? that, yes.
Yeah. Holy shit. Wow. This is what the majority of the population thinks or knows about queer people.
Yeah. And it's not much. I mean, we've had,
it's not much.
Jessica Halem has been on the show before.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Right on.
And she works at Harvard Medical School. She's a resource for both training med students and also offering support to LGBTQIA med students. And I've been to some of her trainings and they're really amazing. But as you said, there isn't necessarily a training that you can go to that like everyone kind of has to take, right? You know how everyone Correct. Has to take like a sexual harassment training now if you work for a company, basically. There is Right. no let's like talk about competent care for sexual minorities. Okay, you have to go to your seminar or your training today. That's just Right. still not true. And so we need kind of advocates, and that includes cis advocates on the inside who say we need to prioritize this.
100%. And I'm glad you brought up Jessica, because Jessica is, I like to think of a cup is half full. So although I'm kind of saying all these things that make people feel kind of cruddy about medical education, there are wonderful people out there stepping up and trying to implement change and slowly implement change. You know, historically, Harvard had a terrible reputation around LGBTQ plus people. I mean, people were, a whole case was brought out to them, you know, a long time ago, where students were found out to be gay and expelled, and they ended up committing suicide because of that, because they couldn't, like, you know, face that shame. So historically, all these larger institutions have, like, terrible reputations as far as how they treat LGBTQI plus people. But now, what's amazing about the Harvard program is Jessica is in charge of this whole organization that's implementing this medical education. But I would say, as happy as I am for Harvard, Harvard is not the standard program, right? It's Harvard. So, you know, it's there's a lot of challenges in terms of getting like a standardized policy put into play. And then also there's tons of medical programs, whether it's MDDO, nursing, etc. And essentially, if you don't have somebody that knows about this information, you're either not getting it or it's false information. And I've had those experiences in classes that I took in PA school, where somebody would talk about HIV transmission as a risk factor being, quote, homosexual tendencies. Now, it's not 1972 anymore. What we do know is that there are certain risk factors for people, but it has nothing to do with how you identify. It has to do with types of behaviors you exhibit, or what types of sex you have, or who you're having it with, and how many partners, et cetera. So there's a long way to go, but I think there's some really great people out there doing the work. You mentioned something about trainings. There are some trainings, but like all the nerds that, you know, that I know, it's a very small community. We know about a lot of these, but other providers don't. So it's something that I always tell people when I go and give speeches about different workshops or medical, continuing medical education workshops that people can go to and get credits as well.
Okay, we're going to take our first commercial break. And you happen to work at the largest LGBTQ center in the country, which is Los Angeles. Also a place that I've gone to for healthcare. So I can't wait to dig into all of your work there. Let's take a break, hear from our fantastic sponsors, including the Pleasure Chest. Why don't you do yourself a favor and treat yourself? Go to pleasurechest.com and get yourself something nice. And when you check out, use the coupon code Tristan and you'll get a free gift. Stay with us, more with Karen Berger when we return.
Hey everyone, it's Kinktober. As the days get shorter and the nights get longer, our friends at the Pleasure Chest will be turning a kinky corner and diving deeper into cosplay, bondage, and a bit more BDSM. They'll be featuring some of their favorite kink folks and products on their site and social media all month long. From pup hoods and pony plugs to sexy costumes and size-inclusive lingerie, the Pleasure Chest has everything you need to kick up your kink or cosplay. Check out their selection of Halloween costumes and accessories before shopping anywhere else. All stores will have candy out and hidden boupons around the store with delicious discounts from October 30th to the 31st. You can also visit pleasurechest.com to see the schedule of their free weekly workshops and save 20% off their most popular kink, cosplay, and BDSM gear from October 25th to the 31st, online only. While you're there, if you make a purchase, use coupon code Tristan at checkout and get a free massage candle. Lately, does it seem like everyone is talking about self-care? Well, taking care of your body and mind is important. For me, maintaining a sexual relationship with myself is part of my self-care routine. I love mixing it up, and I like a little inspiration on that front. Sometimes holding the phone to watch something just doesn't work for me. Dipsy is an audio app full of short, sexy stories to inspire and arouse. This isn't like an audiobook, it's different. It's more like hearing someone tell you the details of an escapade or listening in on an actual sex scene. It's pretty immersive that way, having someone right in your earbuds. The stories are really high quality, they're well produced, and they're original. I like it because you can select from different categories. Hello, BDSM. And get a flavor from the descriptions. You can choose men with women, women with women, and they are growing their men with men section. Start one, see if it works for you. You can always jump to another, and the majority of them are only about 10 minutes long. As for you, my listeners, well, Dipsy is offering a 30-day free trial when you go to dipsystories.com/Tristan. After that, it's just $8.99 a month, and you can cancel at any time. So get your first 30 days free when you go to dipsystories.com/Tristan. dipsystories.com/Tristan. Then call me and tell me what your favorites are.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. My guest today is Karen Berger, who's a physician assistant who works at the LA LGBT Center. So, Karen, your work centers on sexual health and education. And I've got to say from experience that no one has taken a comprehensive sexual history from me except when I've been at the center. I feel like my gynecologist, my general practitioner, anyone, you know, they don't dig into your sexual history at all. They kind of like want to know like one thing, like, are you a lesbian or are you straight? And then they're like, okay, we're moving on. Whereas I've been asked really specific questions at the center when I've gone for STI testing that I'm like, oh, why doesn't everyone else do this?
Right.
Do you find like people feel comfortable when you initiate those kinds of conversations with patients?
So I'm in a very unique situation because people come to me because they have sexual health concerns. So I essentially have the best job ever because I get to talk about sex all day and nerd out and be medical. Mm-hmm. So it's super fun. So for me, it's a little bit of a different scenario. But what I really try to incorporate when I go out and try to train students on taking sexual histories is how to take a sexual history in a primary care appointment. So you're meeting someone for the first time, you're doing your full physical exam, and your sexual history is just as important as any other history you take. There are so many things that can come out in just taking a sexual history. And I like to say in my clinic, because my scope is so narrow, is that my job is 10% medical, 90% mental health and counseling. People might come in for burning wherever, but for whatever reason, that's not really why they're there. And there's other elements to that physical symptom. So I find it to be really interesting in terms of opening up doors to all different other all additional medical and mental health concerns. What's really great about the center, and I know not everybody has access to that, is that we have a variety of other services. So if I have a patient who discloses maybe sexual abuse or intimate partner violence or something of that nature in my visit, I'm able to walk them up to crisis counseling and get them the care they need at that moment. It sounds much smoother than it is, but when anyone's in crisis, we're able to accommodate that. But I heard you mention like how you've never had a full comprehensive sexual history other than the center. Again, medical education is super archaic and super behind the times. So when I think about like the history of an OBGYN, right? So quote, women's health. So that's already narrowing down who is involved in that, right? Even though what we do know from an anatomical perspective is if you have certain things, then you're going to need a GYN, right? Or potentially OB. The education hasn't really caught up to that concept. I mean, I just went to the big PA conference in May, which has thousands of individuals, and I went to all different presentations, and it's so much still on the binary. I went to a presentation on contraception, which the content was great from a medical clinician standpoint, but from a queer standpoint, it was, I was appalled that only men and women, quote unquote, were being discussed as individuals in terms of contraception. So there's a long way to go. I think what's really great about things like podcasts and social media is that you're able to find experts in these areas and get information so that you can bring this information to your provider. And I think that's really shifted in healthcare now. It used to be that you went to your provider and they knew everything and you knew nothing, and you did what your provider said because they knew way more than you. Now people have something going on with their bodies or their mental health. They're going to look things up, have a little bit of an idea of what's going on or the most commons, bring that information to the office. And for me, it just becomes more of a discussion than I know more than you situation. I mean, that's not how it shouldn't be. It's a partnership. So it's a long way to go, but I am a firm believer that education is the key to making change. So that's what I try to do every day.
Okay, are you ready to give out some free medical advice?
Sure.
I'm kidding. No, let's talk about some sexual health issues. And these are some questions that I've gotten from listeners and also questions I get when I'm out and about doing sex education work. I still feel like there's, even now, there's still a lot of misconceptions or misinformation out there. So the first thing I want to talk about is herpes.
Yes.
Okay, so a couple things. Lots of people have herpes. We know that.
Yes, they do.
When you go to a clinic, like a community clinic or public health department, and you get tested for STIs, herpes is not included on that panel.
Correct.
And many people say the herpes test is either not accurate or provides false negatives or false positives. So unpack all we need to know about herpes and testing for herpes.
Thank you for bringing this up. And if you could see me right now, I'm smiling and like giddy because herpes makes me feel like that sometimes. So incredibly misunderstood, so incredibly stigmatized. I do not understand why. I don't know the history behind it, but probably takes the most amount of time for me when I see a patient that has a first-time outbreak or something of that nature. Lots of emotional unpacking, lots of unpacking with partners, lots of unpacking the medical side, the pain, etc. So to go back to the original question, herpes is a virus. There's two different strains of it. It used to be historically that HSV-1 was called herpes labialis, labialis meaning lips, so most commonly seen on the lips of the mouth. And then HSV-2 was most commonly seen in the genital area, so it was called herpes genitalis. However, you can get either strain in any place where there's contact, okay? So I see a lot of HSV-1 historically found on the lips in the anal area because a lot of my patients perform oral sex, so ripping, essentially. I've seen HSV-2 on the lips. So that's like one big D-myth thing. People freak out about which strain it is. Don't matter. Because at this point in your adult life, if you're having a herpes outbreak, chances are it came from some sort of contact with someone. The other thing I like to mention, I think the statistic is 1 out of 6 people have herpes infection. Some of them might know it, some of them might not, meaning some may have shown up on their skin, some might not have. And then as we get older, that statistic gets even higher. And then depending on how many interactions you've had sexually, that's going to change as well. So, you know, you have to take all this data with a grain of salt. If you're having 5 new partners every week, the chances of herpes infection at some point being exposed to it is super, super high. That being said, the reason why we don't do the blood test for herpes routinely is because if you've never had anything on your skin, the likelihood of you having it is pretty high, depending on your sexual practices. So it doesn't really change anything with your sexual behaviors. So just a little bit about transmission. Most commonly, herpes is transmitted when you have an active infection. What does that mean? A lesion on your skin that usually has blisters, that's most commonly there. Not always. In the butt area, it's really hard to see blisters because the cheeks rub together. But usually very painful, tender. Some people will describe it as tingly feeling. Some people will have some fluish symptoms, you know, a few days prior, a week prior. And then this will show up in your skin. But if you've never had any of this, and you go in and you get your routine testing, and then you get a HSV test in the blood and it tests positive, it blows everybody's minds, whether it's the provider, the patient, it's like this whole thing. So the reason why we don't test for it is the majority of people would probably test positive and it doesn't change our behaviors. The other thing to mention is you can also transmit herpes when it's not necessarily visible on your skin. Okay. That kind of sucks. It'd be great to have a vaccine at some point, but we don't. And what can happen is there can be what's called viral shedding. People might feel some tingle, might not, but the reality of most people don't. But if there's any sort of viral shedding, it can be contagious, but you might not see it. So how are you supposed to tell? You can't. So it's super, super, super hard to avoid, okay? If you're sexually active with more than a few partners, it's so hard. Even if you kiss someone on the lips, you can get it. So let's destigmatize herpes. Obviously, you know, have those conversations with your partners in terms of testing and whatnot. But unless, I always say for in terms of disclosure of herpes, unless you have an active infection, obviously don't do that. That's just mean. But if you have it and it's under control, I don't think you have to let every single sexual partner know. I think if you start seeing somebody more regularly, you can open up about that just in terms of keeping each other safe. But the reality is most of your partners might have it as well. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up. That was a good starting point.
Well, and also I want to say that because it's on the skin, various safer sex practices like using barriers, like condoms, for example, may not protect you.
Correct. Correct.
Right. So it's not about bodily fluids. Right.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And you can, there are like cases of herpes, and I'm talking about like the most common cases. So on the genitals, in the anal area, on the lips, etc. You can get HSV anywhere you have skin, technically. Sometimes your body will just get rid of it before it comes out on the skin. And then there's rare cases of herpes where it can actually be an infection on the cervix that can kind of present as a vaginitis or a gonorrhea, chlamydia, and then if your GYN does a swab, it might come back as herpes. That happens sometimes. Sometimes I've seen it in the anal area, again, kind of present more like a proctitis or a gonorrhea back there, and then it comes back as herpes. So that's something to keep in your, what we call our differential or our list of things that might be causing symptoms, but those aren't as common as what we've discussed with the skin.
Okay, we're going to take another break and let people chew on all that information about herpes and also the message about destigmatizing it. It's basically a virus. It's like giving someone a cold, and there are medications where you can suppress it. Everyone needs to calm down about herpes. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, I've got a lot more questions around sexual health, STI transmission, all that good stuff. This is stuff you need to know, or I bet someone you know needs to know. This is like one of those shareable podcasts. You know what I mean? So stay with us. We'll be back in a minute. Hey everyone, it's Kinktober. As the days get shorter and the nights get longer, our friends at the Pleasure Chest will be turning a kinky corner and diving deeper into cosplay, bondage, and a bit more BDSM. They'll be featuring some of their favorite kink folks and products on their site and social media all month long. From pup hoods and pony plugs to sexy costumes and size-inclusive lingerie, the Pleasure Chest has everything you need to kick up your kink or cosplay. Check out their selection of Halloween costumes and accessories before shopping anywhere else. All stores will have candy out and hidden boupons around the store with delicious discounts from October 30th to the 31st. You can also visit pleasurechest.com to see the schedule of their free weekly workshops and save 20% off their most popular kink, cosplay, and BDSM gear from October 25th to the 31st, online only. While you're there, if you make a purchase, use coupon code Tristan at checkout and get a free massage candle. You may know me for creating various forms of media centered around sexuality, gender, relationships, feminism, and pop culture. I'm ready to take a big risk and do something completely different, and I hope you might join me. I'm working on a family memoir focused on my own coming-of-age story woven in with my father's. It's a story about growing up, multi-generational queer experience and history, love, loss, and the meaning of home. I started it, and I hope to have it completed by the end of 2019. This isn't just a new book, though. It is way outside my comfort zone, and I've been wanting to write it for years. But I've been kind of terrified to share this personal story with the public. I mean, I'm comfortable telling you about my love of butt plugs, but it feels way scarier to tell you about my family, my innermost thoughts, my mental health, and one of the most significant events in my life, the death of my father. If you want to support me and my writing, you can go to patreon.com/TristanTaramino. Thanks.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I am talking today with Karen Berger, who is the host of Queer Medication, an amazing podcast that I recommend, which is about educating people around LGBTQIA plus issues, educating other physicians, other healthcare providers, and also the general population. So recently I was at an event. This is a good one, Karen. And I got a question from someone. You know, sometimes I get questions where I honestly say, I don't know. I don't know the answer, and I have to talk to a medical professional because I'm not one, right? And someone asked me a question about something. And the first thing I thought was, oh, I don't know as much about HPV as I thought I did. So let me tell you about this very rare case, but I want that to lead into some talk about HPV. Okay, so I met a woman who has a disease called HNPCC, also known as Lynch syndrome, which means she has a 90% chance of colorectal cancer. This is intense, right? And so What she asked me is, how risky is anal sex, even with a condom? She wants to avoid HPV because many strains of HPV cause cancer. So she's got to take these sort of extra precautions. How risky is anal sex, even with a condom, for contracting HPV?
So my second favorite topic to try to debunk is HPV, also known as human papillomavirus. So there's a lot of
excited. You're so excited for my questions.
These are great questions because these are the things that are the most challenging to describe to non-medical people because there are instances where you do have to say, we just don't have the answers yet. So mm-hmm. this is what we do know. Mm-hmm. So HPV is the most common STD in the world. There's over 200 strains of it. Okay. I would say anyone who's sexually active ever in their life has HPV at some point, and there might be more than one strain. There's actually no test for that. So if I walked into a clinic and was like, hey, can I get an HPV test? There's really no such thing as that. There are, however, ways to detect HPV through certain types of preventative exams, such as pap smears. So what we are now seeing happening is, for example, in like oral pharyngeal cancers, so in the back of the mouth, the back of the tongue, we're seeing rates of like smoking types of cancers go down and HPV-related cancers going up, okay? So sorry, I brought up the C word, cancer. But when it comes to HPV, there are specific strains that can predispose you or be cancer-causing or carcinogenic. So when somebody goes in for a routine cervical pap smear, that's essentially what we're trying to prevent. We're trying to prevent cervical cancer. And sometimes that pap smear will pick up on some HPV-related changes. Just because you have HPV on a pap smear doesn't mean you have cancer, okay? Not true at all. However, we do know that certain populations have higher risks of certain types of cancers. And because maybe your immune system isn't as strong as somebody who doesn't have those things, you might not fight off wimpy things like HPV. So tons of strains. Sometimes they show up in terms of pap smears as some irregularities. Sometimes they can show up on your skin in the form of warts or condyloma. And that can be most commonly in the genitals and the anal area is what I see. Sometimes you can get them in the mouth. It's not as common, but it all depends on like your immune system. So HPV, I would suggest everyone to get the vaccine who qualifies for it. You might have heard of Gardasil.
Okay, let me interrupt here. This is a great part. So we have now that we have a vaccine, we have the ability to eradicate this, like polio people. First it was just being given to girls.
FDA approved for girls.
So it was like 12 Correct. To 20 or something. And then yep. it was approved for boys. And I already knew some boys and men who are having it. Correct. Now it's approved for everyone, except there is an age limit.
Right.
It won't be covered by, like, so I'm a 48-year-old woman who still has an active sex life and has a lot of different kinds of sex with a lot of different kinds of people. I should get the HPV vaccine.
Well, no, I said you should have an active sex life.
Most people do. Okay. So, but should I get the HPV vaccine?
Yeah. So, okay. There's a couple different things. So just in general, the HPV vaccine, the one that's currently will protect you from the most strains is called Gardasil or 9-strain protection. And the strains that we worry about in terms of being like cancer causing are 16 and 18. So all the vaccines, whether you get the vaccine with 4 strains in it or 5 or whatever, they will include those 2 strains. It's the only vaccine that I know of that prevents cancer. And when I say cancers, this can be cervical cancer and anal rectal cancers and then oral cancers as well. So that's where we're seeing most commonly HPV-related cancers. So you bring up a great point. So okay, at first it was FDA approved for girls, which to me is absurd because as far as I know, anyone with a butt can put something in it. So that can increase your risk for HPV. So already that's kind of bogus, right? And then it was FDA approved for everybody. Great. Now we're on the same page. But a lot of young like pediatricians and have struggle kind of being able to educate their patients and their patients' families on why the vaccine is important because nobody wants to think about children having sex. Well, that's not the point, right? It's like over time is how many partners you're going to have over time can essentially increase that risk of HPV. So it used to be approved through the age of 26. However, it, like where I work, we kind of knew like this is kind of weird. So we would always discuss like the risk benefits of doing it and not doing it. Because some people really wanted to do it and they wanted to pay out of pocket to do it. And even with our, the LGBT center is a federally qualified health center. So we do get government funding and government pricing for pharmaceuticals. So it's very low prices. But even with that, the HPV vaccine is $200 a pop and it's three doses if you've never had it before. So it's an investment. But the way I look at it is if you can, you're basically investing in preventing a certain kind of cancer that you might be higher risk for. So yes, the FDA just extended that approval through the age of, I believe, 45. But anyone can get the vaccine. It's all about risk benefits. And all of these FDA approvals are on these big studies. But, you know, this is kind of a new-ish concept, these HPV-related cancers. So to me, at this point, vaccinating anybody is reasonable.
And you touched on this, but I just want to cover this also, that they're linking more kinds of mouth and throat cancer to HPV than we ever have before. Is that right?
Correct. So we're seeing rates of smoking-related cancers going down. It's specifically in the back of the throat, the pharynx, and then the base of the tongue, where we're seeing these cancers pop up that are HPV cancers. Not all of them are. But there's the rates are going up there. And the problem with that is there's no screening test for that right now. So there's no swab. There's nothing like that. And just to touch a little bit on screening tests. So for the cervix, we have the pap smear. And then, and I think this is kind of going back to the original talk about the participant with Lynch syndrome. And their risk for cancers is this concept of an anal pap smear. So who is at risk for anal cancers? What do we know of?
Next question. If you could see my script, Karen, I swear to you, my next question was going to be, who needs to get their butt swabbed?
Yes, I love it. No, we're jiving.
Okay.
So in general, rates of anal cancers are extremely low in the United States. However, they're going up. And actually, right now, we only have binary stats on gender-related like risk factors. And we know it's actually higher in women. So people who are at risk of anal cancers are people who maybe their immune systems, they might have different physical medical conditions that affect their immune system. So we, for example, see higher rates in HIV positive people who have been living with HIV for a long time, or when they are diagnosed, their baseline immune system was extremely low. Okay. And then anyone who's had any sort of transplant, an organ transplant, they're considered to have a lower immune system, one, because they've had a transplant, two, because of the medications they take. You know, and then anybody who has what's called, anyone who's considered what's called immunocompromised. So people who have any history of any other types of cancers or are currently on chemotherapy, et cetera. You know, where I work, is mostly, HIV positive people. So I'll kind of talk more about that. So there's no standardized protocol for who should get a pap smear, how old you should be when you get a pap smear, when you should get a pap smear, how often you should get an anal pap smear, I should say, specifically. So right now, there's a huge study going on called the ANCHOR study. It's the first of its kind to actually study these things that I just mentioned so that we can move forward with creating protocols. So what we do, and actually one of the jobs that I do at the clinic, is I do something called a high resolution anoscopy. For anyone out there who has a cervix and ever had an irregular pap smear in the cervix and had a colposcopy, which is basically looking a little closer at the cervix to see if there are any irregularities, a high resolution anoscopy or HRA is a colposcopy in your butt. Okay. So basically you're looking at this area in the body that is super unique, where the cells in the anal area are actually different than the cells in the rectal tissue. And at that junction where those two cells meet, sometimes we see some changes happen. And that's most commonly where you see some irregularities form. So what we do, we do our screening tests, our pap smears. If they come back irregulars, sometimes they're just like the most general, this is atypical, but we don't know why. Or sometimes it will pick up some like more what we call low grade stuff, which is like warty stuff, which is totally normal. And sometimes we pick up this high grade stuff, which is stuff that, you know, we might want to get rid of so that it never has the potential of becoming a cancer. So the answer to your question is there is no answer to your question. We don't know any protocols. However, what we do know is we see higher rates in certain populations, and those populations should be screened for anal pap smears at some point. It's something you should definitely talk to your primary care about.
Okay. And if you're doing anal play, especially with cis penises, you should be getting an anal swab. Yes?
Well, so we don't know the answer. I would say at this point, the answer to that is no, because we do know that the rates of any sort of cancers back there in HIV negative people, or what we call immunocompetent people, are rarer than anal cancer itself. Okay. So right now, the focus on the ANCHOR study is specifically on people who are high risk, which is people who are HIV positive, have had organ transplants, or other types of cancers in their lives. We haven't even gotten to the general population yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good to know.
Because the reason for that is as somebody who has an immune system them without any medical conditions, typically if they are exposed to HPV at any time in their lives, and they maybe do have some of these changes or irregularities, the likelihood of their immune system getting rid of it on its own is extremely high. But we don't technically have the data to quite support that yet, except that most people with strong immune systems don't get anal cancers.
Okay, the next thing I want to talk about is queer women's healthcare. For very good reason, within queer communities, gay men have taken up a lot of space because, beginning with the AIDS crisis, we had an actual pandemic on our hands. Gay men and men who slept with men were more at risk. And so I feel like there's a general awareness around like health and screening issues for men who sleep with men. But then when it comes to women who sleep with women, or people with vulvas who sleep with other people with vulvas, I feel like there's this sense that like they can't get STIs and that they're not at risk for anything. So like all the lesbians I know and queer women I know are real lax about going to the doctor. And I know this, I know that getting your sexual health taken care of is important to your overall holistic health. So I want to know what are the most important things we can be doing as women who sleep with women?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. So I think in general, women in medicine, they've been kind of put on the back burner in general. Although we've had, quote, women's health forever, I don't think that it necessarily took a holistic approach to the person in front of you. It was a lot of times about reproduction or essentially getting someone ready for reproduction. And obviously, there's many people that don't fit into those categories or aren't sure if they fit into those categories. So, yes, I think, the AIDS crisis was an absolutely horrible thing. And if it wasn't for the community, it who knows what would have happened. That being said, you know, the community is a lot bigger than people with living with HIV. So, you know, I think the way I like to explain to my students is I always go through like the labels and the terminology with them, but I ultimately take the approach of, for me as a clinician, what are the most pertinent things and why am I asking them? So I really don't care how somebody identifies on a form or in an intake or something like that, unless it's pertinent to the questions that I need to ask. I'm more interested in knowing what you're doing, who you're doing with, how you're doing it, and how many people you're doing with. And like who's involved so we can make sure everyone feels safe. So, you know, I think just to say one thing, you can get gonorrhea and chlamydia if you're having any sort of vaginal sex at all, whether that's two vaginas, neo-vagina. So that can happen depending on your sexual practices, whether or not you're using any sort of toys or dildos or things like that. All of that can actually happen. You can essentially get any STD from having any type of sex. We do see higher rates of certain STDs based on the type of sex people have. So, for example, any sort of receptive anal sex, the tissue is very thin back there. There's lots of fluids back there. You can get a tear. Things can stay up there and get trapped up there. So essentially that, for example, is why that's the highest risk type of sex for HIV transmission. But think of it in the same way for any sort of bacterial infection as well. So you can get gonorrhea and chlamydia back there. So if you're putting anything back there, whether it's a tongue, a dildo, a penis, whatever, you should test back there and you should talk to your primary care or wherever you get your testing done about doing a swab back there because things get caught back there. Same goes for the oral cavity. A lot of people don't think about that, but you can get things in the back of your throat, and over 95% of people who have something back there don't have any symptoms. So in terms of going back to the original question, you know, if you label yourself as lesbian or bi, or you're just women who have sex with women or attracted to, or that's the type of sex you're having, you should take care of yourself like anybody else. You can get any sort of STDs. And I think it's important to have those conversations and hopefully you're able to be open with your provider about that. And if you don't feel safe there, go somewhere else if you have access. I think one great thing about like current medicine is that we have access to what's called telemedicine. So if you don't like someone who's in your area, you can find somebody and actually have like video Skype chats and do your medical care through that. So I think there's a lot of options to find competent providers in that way.
Okay, that's a really good point because I do think one of the benefits of telemedicine is going to be about more access for folks who live in rural areas or who live in places where there is no gay and lesbian center, essentially, right? There is no practice dedicated to sexual and gender minorities. Okay, well, this has just been a great conversation. We only have 1 minute left. If you could tell every person who walked through your door one thing about their sexual health, what would it be?
Your sexual health is just as important as any other healthcare, and the more information you know, the better you can advocate for yourself and be able to get what you need to keep yourself safe, but also to still continue living your lifestyle and having a great time doing so. There's always going to be, you know, not consequences, but with all the fun things that you do, sometimes you're more at risk for infections. If you go on a preventative medication like PrEP, you might have some side effects in the beginning. So nothing is perfect in the world. So there, everything comes with something else, right? But I would say you should always advocate for your sexual health. Know that if your provider only orders a test in your genital area, that then you might have to teach them that you need a butt swab and a throat swab. And don't be afraid of herpes because you might already have it.
Okay, good lesson. And I just want to briefly say PrEP is pre-exposure prophylaxis in case you didn't know. It's a medication that HIV negative people can take, and when taken regularly and as directed, can prevent them from getting HIV. Just want to give that little side note. Thank you so much, Karen. If you guys want to know more about Karen, you can go to queermeducation, that's like with an M, queermeducation.com. And also the podcast is called Queer Meducation, wherever you get podcasts. Also, she's at Queer Meducation on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My gosh, thank you. I really appreciate it. And feel free to email me with any other questions regarding what I discussed. And thanks for your time.
I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, senior producer Raymond Johnson, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, A-Rod, my engineer, everyone at Voice America. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern for another edition of the show. My guest is Michael Paramo, and we're going to be talking about asexuality. Until then, you can get me across all social media platforms at Tristan Taramino and the show on Twitter at Sex Out Loud Radio. Take some time to talk about your sexual health out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.